Transportation Policy Committee come to order. Quick informs me that we have a quorum. So in honor of Senior Respondent and First Representative Olson, I would like you to move the minutes from whatever date. Let's see, what's the date we're looking at here? If I could find the set of the minutes. Minutes of March 21st. Would you oblige? Okay. Is there any discussion of Brandon minutes? Well, you can approve them.
Approve them nothing?
At least
they
have
to
be
ratified. Oh. Well, we'll do it next time. We'll have to come next time. Okay. All right. Our next meeting is Tuesday, March 28th, which is the, I think it was the 28th, the first deadline.
28th.
Yeah.
I mean,
that
was
the
Bahamas.
How's the meeting going today so far? 28th. Was it April? Well, I thought it was just the wrong date. The first deadline. We have scheduled the following bills, and others will be added. House File 3637 Hedberg, House File 3438 Ruth, and two bills continued from March 21st, which are the Blaine Bill, 1838, and Junkies Bill, House File 2734. With that after sight, we will have next House File 3298 by Representative Magnus. Is that the answer? The motion is to pass as amended, because apparently we have an amendment to transportation finance. Welcome to the committee, Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
I'm out of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
I do have an amendment. It's an oral amendment for page 2, line 16. There's a blank there, and in the blank I'd like to put in the figure of $300,000. So basically what we're doing with the bill is taking out $200,000 and increasing it to $300,000. And the other thing we're doing with the bill, Mr. Chairman and members, is we're adding the annual implicit price deflator to have this number that we're adding keep up with inflation. Mr. Chairman and members, today I have with me Mr. David Fricke with the townships and Mr. Ken Solom, and they will answer any questions that our committee may have on the bill.
Well, okay, go ahead. I'm just looking for an amendment here, which I know I have.
Chairman, if I might, I'm Dave Fricke, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of Townships. And I can tell you just a quick, this is something we put into statute a number of years back. It was fixed at $200,000 in net tax capacity. Since then, the value of property has gone up such that we've dropped about 200 towns off of the list that was eligible so that they could have the small towns have their engineering costs picked up on the bridge work that needs to be done that we have such a dire need for. And this simply would add back in approximately 200 towns back to the list and then put the deflator in there so we don't have to keep coming back to you every year. So it's there's nothing really new in it. It's just moving up the number kind of with inflation and so we keep up with it in the future.
Okay. We're just going to incorporate that $300,000 without voting on it. We have it in the bill. Place it we'd like it to be, and you have another witness?
That's the only witness we have.
I'm just here to answer questions.
Does anybody have a question so that we can have them give us an answer?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hubbard,
please. Chair, what is the motion? Is there some coming to my committee?
It's passes a minute. We referred to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just
procedural issue. Just wanted to inquire. Did you incorporate something into the bill?
$300,000 that he offered was an amendment.
It's an oral amendment.
Oral amendment, yeah.
Do we have to vote on that? Just...
No, I just put it in there. Would you like to vote on it? All those
like
in
that.
Favor of...
Maybe not, Mr. Chair. That leads for a good constitutional challenge. No, I think we probably should vote on it, Mr. Chair.
Well, you know, there's a big debate about that. When the author comes in and makes an oral amendment, but we can vote on it. All those in favor of substituting $300,000 for $200,000 and 9.216 of the bill, 3398, indicate that there are any questions, first of all. Anybody have any questions or comments? If not, all in favor of that, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted, and we can continue with questions for the man who came to answer questions, so we ought to get him a question. Does anybody have a question for him?
Yes, sir.
Ah, Representative Anderson, I knew you'd have a question.
Mr. Chair, was that last vote unanimous?
Yes.
Okay.
We could ask for a roll call if you'd like, or a show of hands. All right, is there any other questions on the bill as amended? Nobody cares.
Thank you.
Come on.
Mr. Chair.
All right, well, you might as well take your bill and go off to the next committee then. All in favor of the bill as amended, move to the Transfers Finance Committee, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. House File 3398 is being referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. Representative Hanson, you want to move your bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members, I'd like to move House File 3718 for passage and re-referral, I believe, to Government Operations.
All right. We're ready.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, this bill is a simple, straightforward bill to move Minnesota forward in terms of being a leader in developing plug-in hybrid vehicle technology, flexible fuel plug-in hybrid vehicle technology. Mr. Chair and members, as you know, we are in a very precarious situation with oil in this country. Whoa, I should be turning this off. Sorry about that. Keep forgetting to turn off my new cell phone. But, Mr. Chair, you know, many experts have...
Representative Hornsby, we do have rules about that, but we're not going to say much. The only rule that I'm going to enforce today is no constitutional amendments in here.
Okay. You can rest assured, Mr. Chair, there's nothing of the sort here. To provide some context, members, we are in a situation where many experts have predicted that our the oil production capacity globally has either peaked or is close to peaking. And so we're really in an urgent situation where we have to take whatever measures we can to reduce our dependence on oil, and particularly foreign oil. A lot of the oil coming to the United States comes from very unstable parts of the world. And the reason this bill is before us in the Transportation Committee is that 67% of the oil consumed is in the transportation sector, mainly in the automobile sector. So we have currently now feasible technology to take a traditional standard hybrid vehicle of the kind you see now more commonly on the roads, vehicles such as the Toyota Prius or the Ford Escape SUV. We can take vehicles like that, and actually some people are doing them in garages and other venues, to reconfigured the battery in such a way that it could be plugged in overnight, and then the first 30 miles are on electricity alone, and thereafter you're capable of getting over 100 miles per gallon. And then when you add in the flexible fuel, apparently, you can increase that mileage even further. And so this is not some pie-in-the-sky futuristic vision. The technology and the components of this technology are here now. The president was just in Wisconsin a month ago at the Johnson Works facility, and the reason he was there is he was promoting the very kind of battery technology that will make these kinds of cars feasible and ready to be mass-produced. There's a couple of barriers, and this is why, Mr. Chair and members, we need a local and state government engagement in this issue. We need to send a message to the automobile manufacturers, quite simply, from Field of Dreams: if you build it, we will come. We know that consumers like hybrids. I believe that with gas now up at $2.50 a gallon again, people will like the fact that they can get this. Really translates to about 50 cents a gallon when you look at the electricity produced that's needed to power these things, these vehicles. I think the consumers will be demanding these once the manufacturers make them. So, to sum up, there's two sections of this bill. Number one is simply to say that the state of Minnesota will purchase these kinds of vehicles once they are available, which could be within a few years. The reason we need to do this is that there needs to be statements, again, from state and local governments across the country to the manufacturers that we are ready. We are ready as a state to lead by example, not only in our fleet purchases, but in leading by example in terms of the citizens and the constituents that elected us, that we are really serious. We are serious, not just rhetorical, about lessening our dependence on foreign oil. Secondly, we have a situation in which there's some important environmental consequences, particularly global warming. Many of the particulates that contribute to global warming are from automobiles. That's section one. And then section two, very straightforward. We have a facility, and you may not know this, Mr. Chair and members, but Mankato State University, well, I always do this. Minnesota State Mankato has one of the only accredited automotive engineering departments in the country. And we have a professor who will talk just briefly about that in a minute. This department is able to conduct research where we can give them, as I said, a couple of these traditional hybrid cars, and they, with a small grant that's envisioned in this bill, will be able to retrofit those vehicles, Mr. Chair and members, so that they could be flexible fuel plug-in vehicles. They can test them. They can evaluate them. This kind of research will be very, very important, again, in demonstrating this technology. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions about the bill. I do have two witnesses, and, you know, we can move forward pretty quickly, I believe.
Is there a prototype somewhere in the United States now that we're talking about here, or is this something that's still on the drawing board?
There is, and I'll let Dr. Morris speak to that. This is Dr. David Morris from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, which is an economic development think tank, if you will, based in Minneapolis and Washington, D.C.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm also on a congressionally created advisory committee to the Department of Energy and was appointed by the Secretary of Energy under President Clinton and reappointed by the Secretary of Energy under George W. Bush.
You want to use the mic, and also you want to say your name there so that...
Yes, my name is David Morris. I'm Vice President of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance here in Minneapolis. You asked if there's prototypes. Daimler Chrysler actually has a little over 100 Sprinter vans, which are plug-in hybrids on the road right now, and they'll have about 200 probably within the next 4 or 5 months in the United States. So they're for testing purposes. They're not available commercially. There are two companies, one in California and one in Canada, that are now selling retrofit kits. That is, you can, for fleet vehicles, that is, you can buy a kit that converts your Prius or your Ford Escape into a plug-in hybrid, and the kit basically has some software changes and then a larger battery pack. So this is not, you know, this is something that really is there. And you know, one other point is that the hybrid car is a marvelous device, but people are finding they're not quite getting the mileage that they thought they were in terms of improvements. One of the nice things about a plug-in, if you think about a hybrid right now, it's an internal combustion engine car with a motor assist. That's what the hybrid is right now. When you can plug it in with a larger battery pack, it becomes an electric vehicle with an engine backup. So it has all the advantages of an electric vehicle without any of its disadvantages, being performance limitations and a very heavy battery pack. And when you travel on electricity, you're saving an enormous amount of money. As Frank said, 50 cents a gallon equivalent for every mile that you travel on electricity. So there's really a savings that is quantifiable with a plug-in.
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to conclude and just say one other thing, which is, you know, we would be among the first states to really take some state legislative and policy action. There's some legislation pending at the federal level. We have many municipalities that have passed resolutions and ordinances saying that, again, when these cars are available, they'll purchase them. But we have four things in Minnesota that really make us uniquely positioned to be a leader in this. Number one, we have our ethanol industry. Number two, we have our increasing wind industry. We have the Ford plant, which is it's a resource that's in transition. We don't know what will happen with it, but there's a lot of proposals floating around that Ford would be able to make cars that people would be demanding more of in the future. This is one of them. And then finally, we have this great resource, and I would like to bring up Dr. Jones to talk a little about Minnesota State Mankato's Department of Automotive Engineering and the kind of work that they're going to do, again, very briefly, Mr. Chair, as envisioned in this bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair and the rest of the committee. Thank you. We have an automotive engineering technology program at Mankato. I think many of you are aware of that. I saw you last year. And we have been doing quite a bit of research over the years on a lot of different alternative fuels, including ethanol. In addition to that, about 2 years, well, 2 years ago, to be exact, we did have a Toyota Prius that was owned by a private individual and did some experimentation and testing on running it on higher ethanol blends. We were able to gradually increase the concentration up to 85%, but periodically some of the fault or the trouble lights and things like that went on, so the computer was seeing some things that it didn't like at that point, and we really couldn't get too far into it because we didn't own the vehicle and it was a private individual's and we didn't want to start taking things apart. I was joking earlier this morning that I always tell my graduates when they're students in my class, that someday they'll be of use to me. We've got individuals that work at Toyota and Ford, and this is a pretty good, excellent opportunity to use some of that to try to get into some of those systems that the manufacturers don't readily make available. In addition, the company in California, I contacted them also about their plug-in hybrid, and actually before that, this past fall, they had sent an email out to us because they have interest in developing their system and making it flexible fuel. And they had seen the paper that we had done a couple years ago on the web and contacted us expressing interest. So this potentially could be a project that could get corporate sponsorship and things like that from companies outside the state, and also Canada is one of the other companies.
And, Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that this would be the first of its kind research. So, and I was really pleased that they just need a modest amount, $100,000. Eventually this will go to the Higher Ed Finance Committee. But those are the two parts of the bill. And in Section 1, there is actually, Mr. Chair, I forgot, an A1 amendment I'd like to move. It's an author's amendment.
These students forgot their deliverance off of the tape.
I'm sorry.
And so I don't know how I was going to introduce you to the tape here, but then Representative Hanson cut me off, so I didn't get a chance to do that.
I'm just too excited about this issue, Mr. Chair.
So you want to move your amendment now?
I have one amendment, and I can quickly explain it as well.
Okay. Representative Hanson moves H3718A1.
And, Mr. Chair and members, this is language that I was able to work out with the Department of Administration. There were some concerns about some of the specific numbers we had had for procurement in the original bill. So we were able to make this a little more realistic in terms of the data that they presented me in terms of what the state actually procures in terms of new vehicles. Again, the state has all kinds of things from snow plows to what have you, and so the first lines 3 through 6 really define the kinds of vehicles that I think would be suitable for plug-ins, given the research that's been done already. Passenger automobiles, pickup trucks, and vans, SUVs, etc. And then we just deleted some of those numerical specifics in 22, 23, and 24 the Department of Administration had concerns with. I wanted to really thank the Department of Administration and Mr. Rhodes as well for helping work this through with me. So, you know, my understanding is that they're okay with the bill in this amended form.
More questions or comments on the amendment?
Not on the amendment.
What do you want me to do? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Hornstein. Let me understand why where we're at line 23 or 1.9 on your amendment. You talk about 1,000, and yet when we get to 113, we're talking that we're purchasing approximately 800.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, this is a little bit, I anticipated this, and I will take a shot at this, but then Mr. Burris can as well. That is actually not, the language doesn't imply, if it implies, we need to correct it, but the language literally does not say purchase of 800. It's simply there for informational purposes to say that that is roughly the average number of new vehicles of the type envisioned in lines 1 through 6 that are purchased by the state on an annual basis. And so really that's for informational purposes. It doesn't say that we're going to, that all 800 vehicles will be plug-in hybrids. That's why we have the language on line 7 in the amendment, whenever practicable. But this, I think, accomplishes what I would like to do. I think it would be nice to have specific numerical goals, but that it didn't seem feasible when in my conversations with the Department of Administration at this time. But I think it does accomplish the goal of sending that message to the automobile manufacturers that as a state, it's our intent to buy these. And that's really what the language says, it's our intent. So it's not Representative Nelson saying that we're going to purchase all 800 of these vehicles as plug-in hybrids.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
Can you describe to me what the difference between a hybrid and a plug-in hybrid is? I'm reading this bill and how they're going to deliver electricity to a utility.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. There is a real connection with the utilities, and we have the person to answer that. You can come to the dais here and state your name for the record. And
I'm Jim Walters, Director of Customer Relations at Rochester Public Utilities. And could you repeat your question, please?
Well, I want to know what the difference between a hybrid and a plug-in hybrid is, because it seems that the plug-in hybrid can, according to this bill, transfer electricity to a utility. How does that all go about?
Okay, firstly, the difference between a hybrid, which is what I drove here today, and a plug-in hybrid, as Representative Hornstein referred to, is what I'm driving is predominantly gas, and there is an electric assist. A plug-in hybrid, or a flexible hybrid as it's referred to, is an electric vehicle with a gas assist. So I think your next question was then the implication for utilities, is that right?
Well, in terms of the utility, was what the 1.12 says in the, this was 1.14. The vehicle must be able to recharge its battery and transfer electricity to a utility.
I'm not familiar with that part, so all I can surmise from what you've said is that if the vehicle has a full charge, in essence, you could transfer that energy, I suppose, but I don't want to comment much on that because I really don't know.
I think Dr. Morris could take a crack at that.
Well, basically, if you have a plug-in socket, then you're connected now to the electric grid system, and you're connected as a customer, but potentially as a producer. So you can bring the electricity in from the grid system to charge your battery. That's what you'll commonly do. But you could also potentially push electricity into the grid system. You could use your battery to in case of a blackout, into your car. Into your house, for example, as sort of a backup. And there have been a number of studies done by quite sophisticated analyses. This was in the state of California, about how much the value might be of your car. So these are futuristic studies, but utilities need power for a lot of different purposes. And these studies indicated that a utility could sign a contract with you, and therefore it could, in essence, take over your car. You know, when you're at work, your car is there for a number of hours a day, and during those hours of the day, the utility might need some extra electricity for one purpose or another, and they could get it from your car and sign a contract with you. So in essence, if you have a plug-in, it will 90% of the time, if not 99% of the time, be used to recharge your battery. But it could, in effect, become part of the electric grid system, and there's a number of utilities that are beginning to look at it not only as an increased customer for their electricity, this is a whole new sector that could be electrified, but also as very small generators that can be used in different parts of their distribution line to stabilize the system.
Well, is the gasoline engine after the first 20 or 30 miles recharging the battery? Is that the deal? And then it runs continuously from the recharge battery, or does the gasoline engine take over to drive the car like in a hybrid?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the way that hybrids now work, and there are two different kinds of hybrids, at least broad categories, the Ford Escape and the Toyota Prius actually run on electricity for a very short distance. The Honda and the General Motors hybrids don't. They're not designed to run on electricity at all. They use electricity to get more propulsion, higher horsepower, if you will. So they're sort of different in that sense. But let's look at the Toyota and the Ford Escape. You use electricity, and then at a certain speed, the engine kicks in. So you're using the battery, only discharging it a very, very small amount. And then you recharge it when the engine kicks in. So that's the way the current hybrid works. With a plug-in hybrid, you have different kinds of batteries and bigger batteries, so you will actually be traveling on electricity for 15 miles, 20 miles, 30 miles, 40 miles. You will then exhaust the battery charge to a much lower level, and then over the night, you can recharge it from the grid system. You could also recharge it from your internal combustion engine system, but that's a pretty expensive way to be recharging your battery. So that's how it might work.
Yeah, if I may, could I comment on that, Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
That really is the beautiful part for utilities. Utilities are always looking to fill those valleys. You know, we have peaks in August when it's real hot and all the air conditioners are running, and then in the wintertime about now, we don't have much of a load. So from a sales perspective, what Dr. Morris talked about is right on the money. You can charge these vehicles during times when there's plenty of capacity available. The load factor for the utility goes up, and that's downward pressure on rates. So that's what really excites me.
After the 30 miles and you've exhausted your battery, are you running on gasoline alone then?
Well, we would hope that, Mr. Chairman, this would be a flexible fueled car, you would be running on ethanol. Then it would be a regular internal combustion engine car, maybe a little bit more efficient because the engine would be smaller. But yes, in essence, that's what. So you basically, electric vehicles are marvelous because they're quiet, because they're non-polluting in urban areas, because they get the equivalent of 100 miles per gallon when they're driving on electricity, and because at current electric prices, it's between 25 and 50 cents a gallon. The problem with all electric vehicles has been the performance limitations. You can only go a certain number of miles, and then you got to recharge, and it takes several hours, and the batteries are expensive, and they're very heavy. The nice thing about putting those two things together, the hybrid, the internal combustion engine car, and the electric batteries, is that you overcome performance limitations, because after the 20 or 30 miles, if you're on a 60-mile trip, 100-mile trip, 200-mile trip, well, then you have the engine kicking in just the way you would normally.
It would seem to me that you, on a 200-mile trip, you're really not saving very much if you only go 25 to 30 miles an hour on your electric, and then you're running on gasoline the rest of the way. But I may be wrong about this. Is this primarily a town car to be used in local?
No. This is a car that you can go across the country. You're right. If you go 200 miles and you only have a 30-mile electric only, that you're going, 85% on gasoline, but the average Minnesotan travels 25 miles a day. So in terms of average travel, this can take care of 100%, in theory, of your travel. Travel within urban areas is often 1 mile, 2 miles, 5 miles, 3 miles, and so forth. So this can be a very substantial amount. So if you live in a rural area and you're traveling a couple of hours a day, the electricity would probably be 20 to 30% of your total miles driven. If you live in an urban area and you're traveling 20 miles a day, 25 miles a day, it probably would be 65 to 90% of your driving miles.
Mr. Chairman, may I make a comment again?
Yes.
I think you've hit on a very good point, and that is that research that I've done, most intriguing to me, is in Atlanta, where the Olympics were held here a while back, and traffic was not allowed to, during the Olympic Games, was not allowed in the Atlanta, Georgia area. And they ran tests, and they found that pollution had reduced by an order of 75%. The point is that the real advantage from a mileage per gallon and from a health perspective is in-town driving, and that's where these things, where plug-in hybrid vehicles really shine, and I think that's an important point to bring out here.
Let's see,
he answered it.
Okay, do we have any other questions? Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions, but not on the amendment.
Excuse me?
I have questions, but not on the amendment.
Okay. Well, we're still working on the amendment. I guess anybody else have any questions on the amendment? Comments? If not, all those in favor of H-3718-A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted, and we now have the bill as amended before us. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know to whom I would direct the question, but one of the law of physics is kind of applied here. We've got an ever-increasing source of hybrid vehicles coming and an ever-decreasing source of revenue. Now, one thing I'd like to suggest how we're going to address that, because we need roads to drive on. And our source of revenue is gasoline, basically. And I was wondering if the university ever thought of maybe air-cushioned vehicles or something else, because we're going to have a real problem. Have you ever checked in your Dr. Morris with Oregon? They have test flight 150 vehicles on a pilot program this year on hybrid vehicles and based on or vehicles using a mileage factor. And I guess the problem here that we're concerned about is a revenue raiser. And while this, I certainly agree with all this, and it's coming, the hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles, but we need to have a source of revenue for you to drive on, unless you're going to get air cushioned vehicles or something. But I was wondering if, with the university, if you have it, if you wouldn't be interested sometime in looking at that, how to, and I think the technology is there. In fact, I know it's there, but it isn't being applied because there's no pressure on the automotive manufacturers to do it. And the states aren't doing it because it costs money to implement it for the dealers. And I think think we should be looking at that issue too, and I might just like to suggest that to the university, because you'd be number one in the country. You'd be up front.
Mr. Chair, Lieutenant Weaver, I don't work at the university. Maybe you were addressing it to Dr. Jones in terms of Mankato, but in terms of the revenue, but I think it's a very important issue, and certainly the government, if you will, you know, needs to deal with it at some point. But in some ways, the loss of revenue would be the same if people bought high-efficiency cars. So we're getting a lot of money off the fact that we drive cars that are pretty fuel inefficient, but as a society, we probably don't want to do that. We'd like to reduce our oil consumption, so we do need to figure out something to do. And one other point, the University of Minnesota did do a study, the Center for Transportation Studies, I believe, a couple of years ago, about pay-as-you-go driving. And although that will send shivers into all of us as a change, we do know that now we have electronic capability in cars, which is where you get your easy passes to go through toll booths and the like, whereby it can charge us electronically and automatically. And there's a number of people who were saying it makes more sense to charge you by miles that you drive rather than fuel that you consume. So there's a number of different ways that one has to deal with it. But you're absolutely right. There would be a revenue source. By the way, there is a tax that is imposed on electricity in Minnesota, so one could, in fact, quantify the amount of electricity that is used for driving the cars, and I suppose the tax on that could go into roads. So there's a number of ways to be creative about this, but you're right, it's a good analysis that needs to be done.
Representative Reisman, are you on?
Well, okay.
Go ahead. Most of the answers are kind of the same, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, I like your bill. And I just, a very quick comment. You mentioned Field of Dreams and Build It, They Will Come and Leading Edge. I'm just wondering if I could use these same arguments on the next PRT bill. Go for it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilson, I think that Dr. Morris could potentially agree with you on that. But Representative Wilson and I mentioned this last year, and I'll say it again, we have something in common, which is we want to move away from the internal combustion engine. And I think that's really the future. And, I think the personal rapid transit's a little separate from this, but this is really, this is ready to go. And within the next few years, and I think the conclusion here is that Minnesota needs to be ahead of, it can be and will be ahead of the rest of the country, and something that's very, very transformative in terms of lessening our dependence on foreign oil. I just want to say one last thing, if there weren't any additional questions, Mr. Chair, and that is that the Rochester Public Utility, as well as many other utilities around the country, have passed resolutions and are very strongly in favor of this. The Rochester Public Utility Board really believes in this, and we have a real good coalition. Mr. Noble from Minnesotans for an Energy Efficient Economy is here, and there's just a great, great coalition of people coming together both nationally and locally to promote this. And I want to return just in conclusion to the argument I started with, which is around our energy security. And just a couple of weeks ago, you may have read, Mr. Chair and members, that there was an Al-Qaeda attack on the largest oil refining facility in Saudi Arabia. And as a matter of fact, I think it produces something with like two-thirds of the Saudi oil. The attack was foiled, but that day, even with this foiled attack, oil prices spiked. And just imagine what would have happened had it been successful or partially successful. So we are really living in times that demand us to take really firm action. And it's almost like a cliche in politics. Let's wean ourselves off of foreign oil. Well, now we have a chance in a very modest but substantive way to start doing that as a state legislature in the state of Minnesota. A lot of rhetoric, but this is something that I think will very affirmatively head us in that proper direction. And again, there's manifold environmental reasons. There's economic development potential in Minnesota through this, both through the ethanol and wind industry, potential job creation also with the Ford plant. So, members, I would just urge a strong a vote as we move this through the process this year.
How does anyone have any figures, guesses, or something? How the hybrid and the plug-in hybrid compare mileage wise in a short 30 mile? The plug-in is going to be ahead, but how about if we go 120-300 miles? Are they going to be equal in cost per mile because they're both going to be using gasoline and so forth?
Mr. Chair, it's a somewhat complicated calculation because one costs more because it has more batteries, but on the other hand, its operating cost is much lower because it's operating off electricity. But currently, in terms of hybrids, as I said, there are two different kinds of hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a Prius or an Escape, you get better mileage in the city. If you have a Honda or a GM, you get better mileage on the highway, which is where most of us get by better mileage, because we're not in stop and go. So you get your mileage savings in current hybrids by the fact that when you're stopped, your engine isn't running. And when you start, you're getting a torque from the motors, and that's the time that you waste the most energy. When you go out onto the highway, you actually aren't getting, because you're a hybrid, you're not getting a great deal more mileage. If you have a smaller engine than you would need otherwise, you might be getting better mileage because of that. In the case of plug-in, as was said before, every mile that you drive on electricity, and with a Prius, you might drive a quarter of a mile, maybe a half a mile, before your engine kicks in. If you drove 20 or 30 miles, then you would probably be driving for several trips during the day. So the answer to this is that the operating cost would be significantly lower, and it all depends on the number of electric miles that you that you differ. But in terms of the Honda and the General Motors, you're really, in effect, comparing an internal combustion engine car to an electric vehicle, and in terms of that, you would get a great deal more savings.
Yeah, just a curiosity question here, Representative Wilson. Have you considered opening this up to other forms, hybrids, or whatever is more suitable, rather than just landing on the plug-ins? I'm not convinced, frankly, that the plug-ins are saving that much here, the way we're talking. For a local town car, maybe.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I think that there's an interesting historical background with hybrids. I think, and Dr. Morse can speak to this perhaps better than I can, but they were originally, the benefits were, the car companies thought that there were minimal benefits to doing this and felt that consumers wouldn't purchase them. And what we found over the last 3 to 5 years is that, there's waiting lists and, they can't make enough of them. This has really been quite a phenomenon in the country. But, and as Dr. Moore stated, there are different kinds of hybrids. But as we move forward with policy statements such as ours that are in support of this, you're going to probably have different kinds of technologies emerging. Right now, it's the Synergy Drive is best suited for this. The hybrid Synergy Drive, which you find in the Prius and the Escape, is best suited for this. That doesn't mean that there will be other forms that won't come along, but I want to emphasize, and I understand, Mr. Chair, some of your skepticism, but because most trips are 30 miles and under, and most people, particularly in the urban and suburban area, are driving that amount or maybe slightly more, we really are looking at 100-mile-a-gallon cars for most people, not all. And I think that is a very substantive move forward. But I don't know if Dr. Morris wants to comment on different kinds of hybrids. I believe that was your question, Mr. Chair.
Well, I don't want to prolong the agony here. I'm trying to dissect whatever the particular... I just was wondering if...
Mr. Chair, if I could just say, the bill says 20-mile range. That's a minimum. That's what people are saying right now. That's how it gets into the market. Mm-hmm. But the EV1, for example, which is a 100% electric vehicle that General Motors sold in the late 1990s, got about a 75 to 85 mile range. And as batteries become cheaper and better, you're going to get 100 mile hour range. And each time you increase that range, of course, you increase the percentage of the miles that are going to be driven on electricity, and until the point where in rural areas you can begin to see the majority of your miles on electricity. So this is, as Frank said, a way to get it on the streets, a way to get it into the marketplace, and as it does, you're going to see the battery development take off, and it won't be a 20-mile range. It'll be, in fact, the kit that I mentioned from the Canadian company has a 45-mile range on electric only.
But for the rural areas, you might want to include chicken droppings or something as a source of energy. But there are several other things that they're using out there now. Does anybody else have any questions? Or, oh, Representative Anderson, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, page 1.20 says, meet the state's performance specifications. That's part of the supposedly the language that's supposed to be on the purchase agreement for the Department of Administration. What specifically does that mean, state's performance? Is that all in the statute that we have those designations?
Mr. Chair, I think that for this one I would like to call up either Mr. Rhodes or someone from the Department of Administration to answer that.
I'm certainly happy to see that you're calling Representative Rhodes. I haven't seen him in front of the committee for a while. Would you say your name for the tape, please?
My name is Tim Morse. I work for the Department of Administration in the Travel Management Division. The specifications are put out for automobile dealers to bid on, and they ask for specific requirements. It might be the size of the vehicle, it might be the number of passengers that it carries, it might be mileage criteria, it might even be horsepower. Typically, though, we'll see vehicle size, number of passengers, when we're talking about passenger-type vehicles.
Mr. Chair, is it Mr. Boris?
Mr. Morse.
Does that mean that the size of the engine or the battery pack, or is that all part of the state specifications that you need when purchasing, or like a plug-in or a hybrid plug-in or whatever you want to call it? It's got to have, the battery pack has to be designated as a specification that you as the state Department of Administration has so designated?
Mr. Mayor. Representative Anderson. That could be one of the specifications. More commonly, they're performance-related specifications. We want to be sure that the vehicle that we're purchasing meets the work requirements of the job that it's assigned to do.
Okay.
Are there other questions or comments?
Yeah.
Representative Seibert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard Hornstein. About how many vehicles do we have currently in the state inventory? Do you know?
Well, I'll take a crack at it if I'm wrong. We have many people in the Department of Administration here that can correct me. But I believe there's about 8,000, is that correct, 8,000 vehicles in the state fleet?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, be correct if we're counting passenger vehicles, trucks, heavy trucks as well. That's the approximate number. That would not include the University of Minnesota or Minsky. That would be state agency.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Seibert, there's also an interesting statistic that I uncovered in researching this as well, which is that there are local units of government that have purchased pool agreements with the state, and then if you add those in, then we have about something like 37,000 vehicles. That's, again, not formally in the state fleet, but, again, public sector in that same buying pool. So it, you know, this becomes somewhat significant then if, we're able to, have these vehicles commercially produced.
Representative Gazalka?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, do we have any idea how long the state keeps a car? In other words, is it 2 years, 3 years, 4 years?
Representative Gazalka, I'll be deferential on that, the department.
Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, that varies a great deal upon the use of that individual vehicle. It could be that it's kept for a minimum of 2 years if it's a law enforcement type vehicle and accumulates miles rapidly. It could be as long as 6 or 7 years if it's a vehicle, we'll say, assigned to the Department of Agriculture and does inspections that don't require as many miles to be put on as rapidly.
Other questions or comments? One thing, Larson, you had a question earlier? Or?
No.
No? Okay. Wow, it looks like we're ready for lunch. All those in favor of House File 3718, as amended, and to be referred to voting and ops, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill passes, and it's going to the voting ops because of the Department of Administration's procurement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members, and I really appreciated the good questions and the thoughtful discussion.
Thank you for all your testifiers. I didn't hear from Rhodes, though. Representative Smith, you have a House file, 3013. Welcome. Would you like to do the amendment first, last, or always?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I would ask that you would move the bill and then take up the amendment. I'll tell you what it does.
Okay. The bill is moved to pass as amendment to transportation finance.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. You want to do the amendment first or no?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Yes. Go ahead.
The A2 amendment, the amendment clarifies that a lessee as well as an owner of the vehicle is covered by this legislation, and it also takes care of some technical corrections to correct errors when the drafting occurred. For example, I think we had a retroactive date. So it adds the lessee to the coverage of the legislation.
Are there any questions on the amendment?
I can't find it.
All in favor of H301382, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and you have the bill. House File 3015 as amended before you. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, the bill establishes provisions regarding something called an event data recorder, an EDR. Anybody who has an automobile built recently with airbags, has what could be referred to as a black box under the hood of their car or somewhere in the car recording their driving habits. It is currently used for various reasons to deploy the airbags in the event of an accident, but does more than that. It records events within the car subsequent to a crash for use later by the manufacturer. But there's a continuing concern, members, and that is that right now in this state, drivers do not have access to the information recorded and contained in those black boxes, even if they know the car has the device. But insurance companies, besides the manufacturer, insurance companies and police departments can access this data under certain conditions. The EDRs can record things, as I said, such as the speed of the vehicle, whether a safety seat belt or restraint was used, and any other vehicle safety information that's hooked up to that computer. Legislation has been enacted in Arkansas, Nevada, New York, North Dakota, and Texas last in 05 to address the ownership and use of the information. Legislation was introduced this year in 14 states, including Minnesota. I think I
found some instance, occurrence, I should say, in New York, where a prosecutor using information from the automobile black box was used as evidence against the driver in that state, convicting the individual in a traffic fatality based upon information downloaded from his car's EDR or black box. So there has been some expansion elsewhere in the country in the use of the EDR other than for safety information for the manufacturer's use. The car manufacturers simply aren't touting the fact that there are safety benefits to their EDRs like they do other improvements in the modern automobile. Mr. Chairman, this is not brand new technology, this is somewhat new technology. It's not just a safety feature. It could very well be a tool of surveillance. And that's the reason that I'm asking this committee to move the bill favorably. Most people don't realize that these boxes exist in their vehicles and that the information could be used against them. There's no regulation in this state. And I believe that vehicle owners should know that they're in their vehicles, how much information is being collected, and that they are the owners of the data, and what can happen with that data.
Roger Smith, are these automatically installed in all new vehicles, 06 and beyond, or whatever? Or is it just in some commercial vehicles or something? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I disseminated a list, but I have a several-page list. In recent years, almost any automobile with airbags has them installed. Buicks, Chryslers, everything.
Do they have a cockpit recording device as well, or no?
Well, I haven't contacted every manufacturer, but basically, I think they were started to record the last few seconds before, during, and after a crash to help them determine how not to have crashes. But the simple fact is a chip that currently can take care of 5 to 7 seconds could easily be modified to record several hundred hours. And on that line, Mr. Chairman, I would tell you that in Minnesota, there's an auto insurance company, Progressive. My notes indicate that they're running a pilot program with 5,000 drivers right now in Minnesota using a device similar to this chip, recording up to 6 months of driving time, including vehicle mileage, time of day, speed, etc. It's called TripSense. It lets drivers choose whether to hand over data from their recorders, and based on their habits, they may get a discount of anywhere from 5% to 25% on their insurance. Well, that's fine. That's one thing. But the fact that you have technology that could be hooked up to more than a few seconds or possibly a global positioning system down the road, I think our state should step forward and say no, the owner owns it, and without their permission it won't be disseminated.
Questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, gentlemen. Representative Smith, but isn't it true that whether we know it or not, if you've got OnStar in your vehicle, they can trip that on and they can global position you and retrieve a lot of data without our knowing that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, not really, because with OnStar, your equipment is subject to your subscription agreement.
What?
Subscription agreement. You have a written contract with your OnStar.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, that's where they sell the package, but in fact, isn't it true that they could turn it on without us knowing? They don't do anything to our vehicle. They do that remotely, and they can retrieve data at any time they'd like.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I think that this bill is an interesting first step towards the owner of the purchaser of the vehicle owning what his money is paying for.
One last question, Mr. Chairman. Are these black boxes like they are in an airplane? They're actually painted orange. So, just some levity there, Representative Smith. So. But it's true.
They're delivered by black helicopters. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I should let sleeping dogs lay. I think there's some differences. Who knows what color they're painted? I think the EDR that we're talking about doesn't record voices, whereas the black boxes do. That's one difference.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, you have on page 2, must disclose that fact in the owner's manual for the vehicle. And I take it it's about the EDR or whatever the event recording device. Would it also be advantageous to say after the word fact verbally at the time of sale or lease transaction?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, our amendment covered that issue. We include a lessee is deemed to be the registered owner as well. So we took care of that with the amendment.
So it's a verbal, when a sale or a lease is being transacted, there's a verbal message translated to the person that he has this particular box in his vehicle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it's the intent of the legislation and mine that when you enter into a lease of a vehicle, that the notice would be in your lease agreement. Not verbal, but would be in the lease agreement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know how many people read their owner's manuals, and maybe that's their fault, but I'm just wondering at the time of that verbally it's been translated in a message form as the salesman writes up a lease or writes up the sale for that vehicle, that it's verbally said, you have this, and this legislation's been recently passed, and it has the implications of the law in relationship to being recorded or information taken off of this particular RS box. I'm concerned about that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, we're on the cutting edge of creating language. I don't believe there's standard language. However, the language in this bill is modeled after several states, Nevada, California, Arkansas, to try to cover it. I think New York may have a law that says it has to be on the windshield. I think that may be a little bit too much, but we're trying to find, and I think we have language that other states have used and that works.
Okay. All right. Representative Walker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, page 2, line 19, a court of competent jurisdiction orders the retrieval. That was one of the reasons that it can be done. Could you explain some examples of what that might be?
Mr. Chairman, hypotheticals.
Yeah,
This subdivision you're referring to, again, states that the owner of the vehicle owns the data, owns the EDR and owns the data, but that it's subject to being retrieved by someone else if the owner consents. If someone goes into a court to get a court order requiring it's being brought forward, for example, I suppose a police department, if there were an accident where the individual was involved, it may be subject to evidentiary discovery. So, but that's what we're talking about. The court would have to require it, and there would have to be a showing of good cause.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah. Do you have any cases that come to mind that where this information has been used in some kind of legal proceedings?
Mr. Chairman.
Curiosity, question?
In what kind of a proceeding, Mr.
Chairman? Legal, some sort.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the dates and times or anything, but a prosecutor in New York, without permission of the owner, and I'm not sure, but it's possible that they just got it by asking for it rather than going into court. An individual in New York was convicted based on the information downloaded from his black box in a traffic fatality occurrence. Maybe the ultimate end of such an investigation and prosecution was just, but the route by which they got there needs to be protected. Their civil rights have to be protected.
Are there any other questions or comments? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Smith, have you gotten any feedback about how this might play out in the civil litigation context in terms of discovery and who would be entitled to this, if anyone?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I don't have any research that shows how it was used, but, you know, use your imagination. I suppose it would be evidence subject to discovery or not.
All right, we're ready to vote on this, I guess. I will end my motion that House File 3015 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to Transportation and Finance. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes and prevails in the minutes of the bill sent to Transportation and Finance.
Thank you.
Next bill is Representative Nelson of House File 3050.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House File 3050 to pass to General Register, and I will have an amendment. And I would offer that amendment to H3050A1. I would move my amendment to put it in the order that I would like the bill, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor of the amendment, I don't see that there was any discussion because it's pretty tough to look at just as a raw number that we're all incorporated. All in favor of House H3050A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign.
No.
Well, I think the amendment is on there. So we will, it's been adopted and you now have the bill as amended before us. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, were to be a teenager with a car during the summer, no school, late nights, and the joys of cruising up and down the highways and byways with your buddies. Unfortunately, this seemingly innocent scenario turns tragic more often than most of us would like to believe or admit. Teenagers succumb to more risky behaviors that lead to crashes, serious injuries, and far too often deaths. The crash rate for teens rises significantly as the number of passengers increases. This is especially true for the most inexperienced drivers. 16 and 17-year-old teens, when driving with no passengers, were involved in 1.6 accidents per 10,000 trips. And an astounding 6.3 accidents per 10,000 trips when you have three or more passengers in the vehicle. Now that last number is three times greater than the accident rate for 18 and 19-year-old teenagers having three or more passengers. The common denominator there is the inexperience of the new drivers. Drivers 16 to 18 years of age are involved in 25% of all of our injury crashes. Drivers 16 to 19 are four times more likely to crash than more experienced drivers. While teenagers represent 7% of our licensed drivers, they are involved in 15.5% of all of our accidents. Members of the committee, there is no insurance policy worth any amount of money, no matter how large that amount is. There is no amount of tears from family and friends that can ever breathe another breath of life into a teenager that has just become a traffic fatality. House File 3050 will serve to remove these less experienced drivers and their friends from the more risky situations by restricting the number of young passengers and by prohibiting their driving between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. It's important to note, members, that this applies only to those new drivers during their first year after receiving their license and that they are under the age of 18. Nationwide, two out of three teens that die in car crashes are in vehicles driven by other teenagers. Traffic crashes are the leading cause of death for our Minnesota teens. Dead is dead, and I'm sorry, just isn't good enough. Passage of this bill, House File 3050, is going to help these young, inexperienced drivers ease into the responsibilities that come with having a driver's license. Our goal with this legislation, as was the goal with the legislation that we passed last year with cell phone use for young drivers, is to promote safety behind the wheel and mostly to help prevent tragedies. Mr. Chairman and members, I do have some other testifiers that I would like to speak before you before we take questions.
Mr. Lanzer, you're welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Gail Weinholzer. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for AAA Minnesota, Iowa. I'm here representing the AAA clubs of Minnesota and the vast majority of our 650,000 members that overwhelmingly want this piece of legislation passed. I draw your attention to three handouts that should have been provided to you. One is the AAA guidelines for graduated driver's licensing. The second is a chart that shows that the more teenagers you put in a car, the greater the chance of success. And the third is a map that shows you which states have nighttime and passenger restrictions across the nation. Since Minnesota passed its graduated driver's licensing law in 1999, it has become apparent that our current law is not comprehensive enough and therefore not as effective as it can or should be. A strengthened law that includes passenger and nighttime restrictions, which 32 states already have, is necessary to keep Minnesota roads safe for our novice drivers and everyone who uses our roadways. Minnesota is one of only six states in the entire nation that has neither a passenger nor a nighttime restriction. As you can see, one state has the passenger restriction, 11 states have only the nighttime restriction, but 32 states already have both restrictions in place. Why are they in place? Because the majority of teen fatalities happen between dusk and dawn, and because the majority of teens killed in automobile crashes are killed in a car driven by another teen. Provisional drivers do not have enough experience to handle distractions of multiple friends in the vehicle, nor do they have enough experience to judge speed and distance after dark. Some people will claim that this is a parental rights issue, but in fact, if you look at the people being killed by teen drivers, two-thirds are not the teen driver, and therefore we would argue it's a societal issue. The AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety took data from the years 1995 through 2004 from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's Fatality Analysis Reporting System and found that in Minnesota during that 10-year time period, crashes involving a 15 to 17-year-old driver killed 567 Minnesotans. Of those 567 Minnesotans, 212 were the teen driver, 171 were their passengers, 155 were the occupants of other vehicles, and 29 were non-motorists. AAA does not see this legislation as punitive in any way towards a teen driver, but instead, society finally stepping up and accepting its responsibility in protecting our youngest drivers so that they may gain the experience necessary to live to drive another day. I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to take questions at the end.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Karen Sitchi, and I am here as a parent. Last month at this time, I had four children. March 1st, I lost my daughter in a car accident, driven by a boy 17 years old that thought that 100 miles an hour over the roads was the way to drive. She was 16 years old, and I instilled in her the fact that driving is a privilege. Students nowadays, young drivers, don't feel that it's a privilege. They think that it's a green card to do whatever they want. We need to pass this so that my 15-year-old can drive safe on the roads. Within 2 weeks after I buried my daughter, we have now had another child killed in our area with 5 passengers in. We are burying him this Friday. 2 kids, 2 weeks. We need to put a stop to this. We need to have this go through Congress. We need this to go through. Our community up there in Princeton is in an uproar, and we need to do something about it. Parents aren't doing their jobs, so I need help taking care of the job for them. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Debbie Poudon, and first I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing the bill today. I've always appreciated your interest in keeping teens safe in our state. Now, I would also like to thank all the other legislators who have supported this issue in the past. My background is in driver education, as I'm a driving instructor and an entrepreneur. On a day-to-day basis, I direct a driving school training with driver education in Minnesota, and I've helped to train over 30,000 teens, so I'd like to think I've seen a thing or two. I'm also a founder of our state-level driver instructor association, and for the last 3 years, I've served as legislative coordinator for the National Driving School Association, the Driving School Association of the Americas that represents professional driving schools in the U.S. and Canada. Also, in the last 2 years, I've attended Transportation Research Board meetings in Washington. I've served on a AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety National Advisory Panel, and I've met with our Minnesota Congressional Delegation in Washington to promote safety issues and to stay actively involved in what to do with, quote-unquote, our teen driving problem. From a national perspective, you probably are familiar with the National Conference of State Legislators. You also may know Melissa Savage, who is their transportation specialist. I recently was with Melissa at a conference, and she reiterated what you heard from Gail and from Representative Nelson, that 26 states in the District of Columbia limit the number of passengers, and 39 states have a nighttime driving limit. The nighttime driving restrictions have reduced crashes during the restricted hours, this is an amazing number, by as much as 60%. And nighttime driving restrictions should not be seen as curfews, but rather to encourage nighttime supervised driving. Now back to what's happening in Minnesota. This is the 9th year that myself and other safety advocates have come before both legislative bodies to ask you to support these provisions. Just considering these 9 years alone since 1998, when we first introduced the 6-month waiting period on a permit for a teen driver, 613 young people between 15 and 19 are dead now. We cannot get them back. I wonder how many could have been saved with these proposed restrictions that we've asked for the last 9 years. And I was happy to hear Representative Nelson quote a very good friend of mine, Mr. John Cummings, the founder of Minnesotans for Safe Driving, who lost his son in a tragic crash, who said, "Dead is dead, and sorry ain't good enough." What can I say that will persuade you that this bill is in the best interest of teen drivers and public safety, and it isn't taking away rights? Please just consider the things that Representative Nelson said. The leading cause of death for Minnesotans is teen crashes. More than the next 4 leading causes. Teen drivers are overrepresented in the crash rates. Just in Minnesota, they represent only about 7.5% of all the drivers, but they represent over 16% of the crashes, and they represent over 14% of all the fatalities, while they only are 7.5% of the drivers. That's what scares everybody. Crashes involving young drivers frequently involve inexperience, driver error, and speeding. Crashes often occur when other young people are in the vehicle, and they occur at night. Teens are disproportionately involved, and also the passengers of teen drivers are involved. The 3 most common contributing factors to traffic crashes are safety belt non-use, distracted driving inattentiveness, and speeding. 43% of teen fatalities in Minnesota occur between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. At my driving school, parents are required to attend a parent seminar. I can show you countless surveys where parents report they need help in enforcing rules in their families about limiting passengers and nighttime driving. I cannot count the number of times a parent said to me, "Wow, that law is a no-brainer, and would it ever help? Back me up." Every state that has implemented passenger and nighttime driving limits has reported a reduction in fatalities involving teens. Please keep in mind that graduated driver licensing is only a beginning for a young driver, meant to ease them into the driving task, provide experience and supervision, and allowing them time to prove that they're ready to get more privileges. And also, finally, please remember that physically, a human's brain isn't fully developed until about age 24. And I anticipate that here in Minnesota that we will continue to license our people at 16 before they're fully developed. So considering that, and considering the overwhelming evidence that we presented, shouldn't we try our best to provide laws that will ensure a driver's safety as much as possible? Parents, unfortunately, you can talk to them all day long, and my experience is they don't make the hard choices on their own, and that puts many other families at risk, and Karen's family is an excellent example. Please let this be the year that our legislative bodies provide this protection to our young people and our citizens. Please support this bill, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for your time.
Mr. Chairman, one last comment, just for the edification of the committee members. Senator Nino, my senator, carried this bill for us in the Senate. Yesterday, the Senate Transportation Committee passed it unanimously and sent it to the floor for to special orders. We stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zappa.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, I do have a question with the amendment that we took out.
Yes.
I should have read that more thoroughly, but I want to give you an example of my kids' ride share to school. They don't take a bus, they drive cars, and my 17-year-old drives two children plus two of the neighbors, and they exchange that, and the other one has a similar situation. Would that be able to happen under this law?
Give me the ages again.
Drivers were both 17.
17. Mr. Chairman, Representative Gazelka, for the first year of their driver's license, no. If they got the license at age 16 and they were 17, yes, they would be able to continue that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that's the way it stands right now, I would be opposed. I think having some parental exceptions was a good idea.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the fear of having some type of a parental oversight on your children's driving? I oppose taking up having the amendment on there. I think that, as Mr. Representative Gazelka just mentioned, that we have children. I mean, if I go into my own experience, when I was 11 years old, I was driving farm truck, delivering feed back and forth between the farms. So at age 16, if I was to try and bring my brother and sister and the neighbor's friends, like he just mentioned, bringing neighbors home after a midnight basketball game or a late night event, I would be restricted as a 16-year-old to be able to do that on my first year of driving license. My concern is that that rights aren't being violated here, but I say you're violating the parents' rights and having some kind of say in what their children in a situation like this could have, and so I would oppose the bill as it has been amended. Had it been left the way it was, I would have been in agreement with it.
Mr. Chairman, if I might address that question, as I said earlier, it's not in our minds a parental rights issue when two-thirds of the people being killed are not the teen drivers. It would be bad enough if they were killing themselves and only themselves, but they're not. Two-thirds of the people they're killing are the rest of us. Secondly, we've spoken with law enforcement, both as sheriff's level, state patrol, and police officers. They are not willing to support the bill with a parental permission slip that allows them to break the law. Third, the bill does allow for family exceptions to the passenger limitations. And fourth, AAA would agree with the police and law enforcement officers that we would not support the bill if there were a parental permission slip to break the law.
And if I might, Mr. Chairman, and Representatives Anderson and Gazelka, but the rest of the committee as well, I think that the state of Minnesota does have a legitimate interest in the safety of all of our citizens. And I think that Ms. Weinholzer's statistics about the fact that they're not just killing teenagers, they're the biggest reason for the rest of us, more experienced drivers, becoming fatalities and automobile accidents in this state as well.
Mr. Chair.
I do have others. You have something on this plane?
Yeah, I do.
Representative Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many of the, being in the industry, many of the accidents with teenagers also include another factor, and that's drinking. And that's why you see so many after 9 p.m. And that's, you know, so my exception, or my concerns is we're making this broader than I think it has to be. So we've got to look at alcohol as one of those factors as well.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Nelson for bringing this forward and thank AAA for providing us the information in January, identifying what a clearly good idea this is. I think that the parental exemption would gut the law, and I think it's good that we took it out, and I hope that we will send this bill out of here with a very strong yes vote.
Representative Moon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to the concerns of Representative Anderson and Representative Gazelka, while I might be able to see the point on nighttime driving, the parental slip issue for the driver alone, in my estimation, really doesn't cover it. I think what you'd need would be parental slips from the parents of the passengers as well. So for those reasons, I think the amendment is appropriate. And I support the amendment. I support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to ask, perhaps, Gail, you know this, how many of the states on your chart with passenger restrictions, how many of those states allow for parents to give some sort of exemption, if any?
Representative Stephen, Mr. Chair, none of them. And as it pertains to the nighttime restriction, 12 to 5 a.m., that is one of the weakest laws of any of the states. Many of the states start as early as 9, 10, and 11 o'clock. It's not a curfew. They can still be out. They just can't be the primary driver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Nelson, I am supportive of this bill. I'm just kind of curious, where did this permission slip clause come from? Was that an original bill or was that an amendment added on?
Yeah. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gazelka, we started with Gazelka. It's contagious from the chair, I'm sorry. But anyhow, it was originally in the bill to start with, and as we talked to law enforcement officials, we realized what a nightmare this was and that, in fact, it guts the bill. It's pretty easy for mom and dad to be gone for the evening or for the weekend and Johnny to decide to go out joyriding and Sister Janie is at home and answers that phone, and yes, this is Mrs. So-and-so, and yes, I did sign that permission slip without any type of verification. We looked at many ways to amend this to keep the strength in there. We looked at add an affirmative defense like we had last year in our cell phone bill, and we couldn't find language that would fit. Then as we started checking other states, we found that they have teeth in the bill, and it does support the parents rather than take away their rights. That's why we put the amendment in to remove it. So.
Are there any other questions or comments? Okay, we're ready for the vote. Mm-hmm. All those in favor of... who made this? What name? Did you?
I did, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman.
I did. Go ahead. Renew your motion, will you, please?
Mr. Chairman, I would renew my motion that House File 3050, as amended, pass to the General Register.
All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
I believe that my ear is telling me that the motion prevails and that the House File 3050 is on the way to the General Registry.
I said aye.
Sure.